Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. Today I'm here with Itamar Turner-Trowering, who writes at codewithoutrules.com about, among other things, programmer productivity. Itamar, welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
Yeah, good to have you here. I've enjoyed your writings for a long time. Maybe one of the first things that I read of yours was something to do with your negotiating a shorter work week and stuff like that. But before we get into that or any of the other topics we're going to talk about today, do you just want to take a second and give a quick intro of yourself?
Sure. I have to admit, I am not a Rails programmer. I've only written very small amounts of Ruby. I've been writing the software for, I guess, 25 years now, starting in the days of multimedia CD-ROMs and doing some web development. And then I decided I didn't want to be a web developer, so I ended up doing distributed systems. So I've worked in Python, I've worked in other languages, a lot of stuff related to Docker, done some scientific computing, I've worked in an airline reservation system, so just a whole bunch of different things. But a lot of what I learned along the way isn't technology specific, and I think that's what we'll be talking about.
Yeah. Pretty much everything that I've read by you, the common thread that runs through it is it just makes a lot of sense, and I tend to agree with most of what you write. And before we dive into, so the topic today, dear listener, that we're going to be talking about is productivity, which is something that I'm really interested in. But before we do that, can we talk for a second, Itamar, about the negotiating a shorter work week stuff that you've talked about, and maybe just like your antipathy, for lack of a better word, of working crazy hours and stuff like that?
Yeah, so and this ties in strongly with productivity, because the basic idea is that there's only a limited number of hours in a day. So if your solution to having a lot of work, and there's always a lot of work, like there's always more bugs and more features, there's always basically an unlimited amount of work you can do. And if your solution to having too much work is to work longer hours, you're not addressing the sort of critical question of how do you get something, the real work, the useful work done, because you're never going to be able to do all of it. So you always have to get down to how do you do part of it that's actually important. And it's sort of a counterproductive approach to work, because there's like this whole body of research showing that if you work more than more or less 40 hours, like there's a little bit of variation, like it doesn't actually increase your output. Like you're working longer hours and your per hour output decreases. And so, and they've done this in a whole bunch of different fields. And so basically you work longer hours and you don't produce anything more. And it's sort of, work theater, like you're pretending like you're doing something useful.
I've never heard that term before, but I love that, work theater.
Yeah, and so it starts in this edit, like a bunch of sort of negative, non-useful attitudes, like about like working hard being like sort of a virtuous in itself, and that's not really the goal is not to work hard. The goal is to get some output.
Yeah, and I want to make a comment there. I think people very commonly conflate working hard with working long. I actually think that we should work hard, but we shouldn't work long. Like, I would much rather show up at the office and just like work my ass off for 4 hours and then go home for the day than like go to the office and putz around and like play a couple ping pong games and stuff like that, and look at Reddit and stretch my workday out to like 10 hours of being at the office. So I'm a believer in hard work, but not in long work.
Yeah. And part of it is also just, you can sometimes get more work done by just spending some time thinking. It doesn't look like work, but it is work. So I got interested in working fewer hours when this happened to me, just sort of out of necessity. I had really bad RSI. I couldn't type beyond a certain number of hours a day. And so I just could not work that. I was working maybe 6 hours a day. And then I had to go home because my hands hurt. And I didn't get any complaints from my manager. Like, no one was unhappy. Like, I was doing fine. And so I realized, like, the connection, I mean, if you work only 2 hours a day, it's harder to get as much done. But like, the connection between how long you worked and your how valuable your output was not particularly, not a very strong connection. And so later on, like, after I had a kid, for a while, I was working part-time and taking care of my daughter the rest of the time, like, when my wife was working full-time then. And so I basically ended up negotiating shorter work weeks at a few companies. And part of that came out of being able to talk about, like, being able to demonstrate that I was productive, and also being able to communicate that I was productive, and sort of being able to do valuable work, even though I wasn't working. Like, the lowest I was, that was probably like 28 hours a week. And it was still sort of worth people's time to hire me.
Is it possible to state in a concise way how you would make the case to somebody that you're still sufficiently productive, even though you're working something less than full time?
Sure. And I should add that, like, this, just from a purely negotiation standpoint, when you're in 20% unemployment in the US, or 25% or whatever it is, and it hasn't percolated as much into programming, but it has, so, like, your negotiating position, like, post-COVID is much worse than it would have been 6 months ago. So it is a harder sell, but, like, there's ways you can probably mitigate that with, like, if your company is trying to cut costs, if you can convince them, say, I'll reduce my hours and correspondingly reduce my pay.
I mean, we could get into a whole debate about this, but
But in terms of the productivity aspect, and this is where it's sort of a good transition point and what it takes to be productive. Like, your job as a programmer is to solve some problems. So, like, if you're working on like accounting software, like, you're trying to solve some problems that accountants have. And that's the product itself. So the overarching, like, big problem you're trying to solve is, how do you make accountants more efficient and waste less time? And then, like, that devolves into a whole bunch of tasks, sort of developing the software and so on. And you can imagine, in your start of your career, like, you show up at a job and, like, they say, you know, we figured out we need to implement this feature. So someone's already identified the problem, and we figured out like, the feature helps someone somehow. So there's a problem this feature resolves. And so they figured out how to implement it. So they've come up with a solution, and they're just telling you, go and implement it. And so if that's where you are in your career, like, you're not it's sort of there's only so much more productive you can be. Like, all the really valuable thing is figuring out what the feature was and then figuring out how to solve it. And, like, you can write the code a bit better and you can make sure you don't waste time, but, like, there's sort of a hard cap on how much value you can provide for the company. And then
that's maybe true. I might look at that in a little bit of a different way. In my view, the difference between, like, the least productive programmer in the world and the most productive programmer in the world is almost infinite, because there are programmers in the world who are so bad that they actually add negative value to the team. And then there's programmers who have zero value. There's programmers who contribute very little. Then there's programmers who can contribute very much, and like, you could give that person, you know, there are people who are so competent that you can just give them a general vague direction saying, hey, we want to accomplish this broad thing, and they can just take the ball and go do all that stuff without any further instruction. So the difference between those two people is huge. And so the best developers are, it doesn't make sense to say that they're like 10% better or 5 times better or even 100 times better, because there are some programmers who, like, you give them a task and they will just never ever figure it out, and then a better programmer will figure it out and figure it out in a timely manner. So that's kind of how I look at that part.
Yeah, so, but even if you, I mean, putting aside the people who are like the negative value, if you are, no matter how skilled a programmer you are, if someone tells you your job for today is to write this feature using this design, right, and that is what you're going to do, given those parameters, there's a hard cap, because there's only so fast you'll be able to do it. And someone has already figured out, like, if it's like, how much more money will we make? Like, they've picked a feature that will make this much more money. And since that's what you're doing, you're sort of limited. And so, and at the other end, if the vague direction end is where you can just look around and start identifying problems, and then you can say, oh, I know that the company's goal is to help accountants, and I know that they're using this feature, and I've noticed that people just, like, this feature that would actually be extremely valuable, no one uses it, and so why is that? And you dig into that, and you figure out there's some, it's super slow, or like it's hidden in the UI or something. And then like, by identifying problems, there's no real cap on how much value you can provide your company.
That's a really good point. And I would definitely agree with that. Regarding your first point about, like, let's say there's a task that's already very clearly defined, there's not a lot of latitude in how you would actually implement it. I would agree to an extent. I think there is a difference which comes when, let's say, you stack 100 of those on top of each other. One programmer might code that in such a way that the code is easily maintainable over time, and another programmer might code it in such a way where the first task they get, both programmers complete it in an equal amount of time, but then the 500th task, one programmer is still very productive because they coded in a maintainable way, and the other programmer can hardly accomplish anything because they've created a mess. Seems like that difference is true, right?
Yeah, and I guess at this point it's worth sort of splitting these sort of skills into two. And on one side, and it's an artificial boundary, but it's an interesting one to think about. And on one side of them are skills about code and technology, and on the other skill side are all the other skills you need. And this boundary is sort of worth thinking about, because you can be the best programmer in the world in terms of, like, how you structure your code, and, like, you can write really fast code and, like, it's really elegant, but if it's not actually, like, if you go off and spend a week writing, like, the fastest piece of code ever, and it's, like, super maintainable and, like, just brilliant, but you're optimizing a thing no one cares about, or performance isn't a bottleneck, like, on a technical level, your skills are great, but on a non-technical level, non-technological level, you're producing no value. And so you need sort of both sets of skills.
Yeah, very true. I would agree with that. Okay, so maybe let's dive in. Before we jump into these, I have a list of bullet points here from your book, but just for context, do you want to say something about your productivity book to kind of tee us up?
Yeah, and so the the idea of the book is that a lot of the time when programmers start talking about skills, they end up being very focused on technology. And like, I love technology. I enjoy writing software. Like, I have a whole other site aimed at Python programmers, pythonspeed.com, where I talk about Docker packaging and data science, and like, I'm working on a memory profiler, and it's all like, this stuff is extremely important, like, to know how to structure code and how to write performance code and how to debug code. And these are all extremely useful skills, but these are all tools, and these tools have to be, you have to build the right thing for no matter how good you are with your tools. If you're building the wrong thing, it doesn't matter. And so there's another set of skills, and many sets of skills. Like, there's communication skills and project planning skills and so on. And my idea with this book is to talk about one broad category of these skills, namely problem solving, that people do talk about, but they often get sort of not mentioned. So like, you'll ask one of the people I interviewed, someone for the book, it's an appendix, and I started asking, what skills need to be productive, and he talks about technological skills, a bunch of understanding technology and how it maps to your computer, and like, he is very, very good at that aspect of things too. He's a very impressive person. But then, if you talk to him about his day-to-day work in some very like stressful and sort of high impact areas, working for the government, and there's a bunch of other skills in there, and those other skills are just that, like, you need both, but those other skills are just as important. And unless you have a very good manager who can make them explicit, it's sort of easy to sort of, you sort of learn it by osmosis, and so it's harder to learn because people don't tend to make it as explicit compared to the technology skills.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of stuff that I didn't even realize that I knew, or like tactics that I didn't even realize that I used, until I started getting into teaching, and I would observe my students making certain kinds of mistakes or just doing things differently than the way I would have done them in a way that's much less efficient. And that is what started to make me realize, like, oh, I actually have this bag of tactics that I use that can be articulated, even though I've never articulated them to myself, that can make somebody a lot more productive.
Yeah, and if you have a really good manager, they will be able to articulate it. But I felt like it was useful to sort of do my best to articulate the ones that I know about, and specifically in the context of problem solving, which, where the most productive side of it is identifying problems, because that's where you can sort of start from your goals and look around and say, oh, this is the critical path to success, or this is the thing that will make us the most money, or this is the thing that will cut us most expenses. And then solving problems, and then the actual implementation, where you can still have some impact and productivity there too.
Okay. So if you're up for it, I have my bullet points here that I got from your book, and maybe we can just go down the list and just go down the list as we have time for it. So the first thing that I have on my notes is don't get stuck, which I think is a great one. And I think that was, if not your first chapter in the book, one of the early ones, which I think is totally appropriate because that's one of the most important things. Do you want to say something about not getting stuck?
Sure. And this is in the sort of implementation phase. Like, if you're just starting your career, this is all you'll be doing. Like, people just hand you clear specs and say, go implement this. But you still do this later on. Like, eventually your work always devolves to coding if you're a programmer. And so here, like, once you have a well-specified solution that you're implementing, like, you can make it more maintainable and so on. But in terms of sort of just the immediate implementation time, you just don't want to be spinning your wheels. And sort of this happens to everyone at whatever level of skill. But with experience, there's a bunch of techniques that you can learn that will help you do better. So time boxing is sort of a basic but technique that, like, once you're an experienced, you do automatically, but if you're just starting out, you might not sort of realize you need to do this. It's very easy to end up in this sort of, you know, you're sort of hitting your head against the wall and things aren't working and you keep going at it and you don't know what's going on. And, like, before you know it, you run out of the amount of time you have to solve your task. And so once you've run out of time, it's too late. There's nothing you can do. You can't change course. You can't change your design. You can't ask for help. And so if you're, like, as an experienced programmer, you'll do this almost automatically, where you'll start this task and then you'll say, I know I have a day. If it's 2 hours in and I still have no clue what's going on, I need to sort of revisit things. Like, maybe I have to try a different approach. Maybe I have to go ask someone for help, like bounce ideas for someone, get more information. And so just by just setting this time limit that's much shorter than your the amount of time you have to deliver the whatever the feature is or piece of code, you can sort of take a break and sort of revisit and see if you're making progress or not just sort of burn up all your time.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I feel like it's bad form for a podcast host to repeatedly disagree with their guest, but I'll offer a different perspective. And I don't actually disagree, but maybe I would say that there is maybe the time boxing approach applies in certain cases, and I feel like it applies less in certain other cases. Sometimes I will advise, like the other day, somebody I'm working with had a problem with their Vim configuration, and he said, well, I'll try to fix this. I'll see how far I can get in like a couple hours or whatever. And I said, like, no, like, fuck that. Like, don't just give it a try. Just commit to fixing it no matter how long it takes. Even if it takes you a week to fix it, just completely work at it until you get to the bottom of it, so then you never have to deal with that issue again in your life. So I think sometimes that is appropriate. And I doubt that you were saying that that is never the way to go. And I would agree that sometimes time boxing is the way to go. Like, for example, at my last job where I worked, we worked with Rails, but also iOS. I hadn't had any iOS experience, and I discovered that I was just about 100% useless when it came to iOS. And so somebody gave me a task, and I spent maybe half a day trying to get somewhere with it, and I just got like nowhere. And after what I felt like was a reasonable amount of time to try, I just kind of gave it back and said, hey, like, it's probably better if you just don't give me iOS stuff, because I just didn't make any progress with this. It would have been inappropriate for me to take that other view and say, I'm just going to spend a week on this if it takes me a week to do it, because that would have been a waste of time. So I just wanted to offer that different perspective too.
Yeah, so it's not, when I say time box, I don't necessarily mean that once you hit your time box, you stop. It's more of a, once you hit your time max, you sort of reorient yourself, right? You say, am I moving in the right direction or not? And then depending on your, you know, the time budget and the importance of the task and what your options are, you might continue, you might sort of decide the task isn't worth doing, you might go and ask someone for help. Because even if getting the Vim configuration right was a thing that was worth spending a lot of time on, it doesn't mean you want to spend a lot of time on it. So maybe if after 2 hours you're still stuck, like maybe you're not going to figure it out on your own. Maybe you want to try a different approach of like trying to find an expert. So it's not necessarily about you hit your time box and you give up. It's more you want to have you want to sort of notice that enough time has passed that you should sort of check in with yourself and say, am I making progress or not? Do I need to change my approach?
Yeah, that's a good point.
How you change your approach depends on the situation.
Something else you said, I believe, in your Don't Get Stuck chapter had something to do with articulating the problem. I actually happened to also write a blog post about not getting stuck, and my first point was similar to one of your points, which was exactly that, articulating the problem. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, and this was sort of a sort of, there's a bunch of places where writing comes into how I think of, like, the importance of writing comes into problem solving. And in the sort of initial, like, you're just in the implementation phase. And so you do have some sense of where you are, but you still might get stuck. And so what do you do then? And so writing things down is useful when you're, or sort of articulating them is useful when you're asking for help. If you go, like, there's sort of more productive and less productive ways, or more informative, less informative ways of asking for help. Like, if you go and ask someone a yes, no question, you're going to get like one bit of information. Like, they will either say yes or they will say no. And you've sort of, but you've taken up a bunch of their time, and in the same amount of time, you could have asked a more useful question. And so a more useful question is, if you're stuck, is, here's what I've learned. Like, I have this problem. Here's what I've learned. Here's what I think is going on, but I can't quite get it. Here's what I've tried. Can you sort of, like, is my guess right? Like, what can you tell me about the solution here? And by doing that, you're sort of, by sort of articulating your the context and what you've learned and what you think is going on, in some cases, you'll just solve that in your head. Like, this happens to many people where, like, as soon as they've actually written down the question to someone else, like, they know the answer.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something about saying what it is you're trying to do. In my experience, a lot of times programmers will be doing something and it's clear to me that they don't have a clear idea in their head of what are they actually trying to accomplish right now. They'll go from one Stack Overflow answer to another and, like, read some random things and try a couple random things. And it's like, hang on a second, stop doing stuff for a minute and just articulate to yourself, what are you even trying to do right now? And pick one thing and even go so far as to write it down, because you're very unlikely to accomplish anything if you don't know what it is you're trying to accomplish. And I also, for myself, if I get stuck on something and I'm considering asking somebody else for help, whether it's an actual person or posting a question online or something like that, I will often think to myself, okay, when I go to somebody and ask, what exactly am I going to say? How am I going to phrase the context and the things I've tried already and stuff like that? And quite often, as you said, just going through that process of articulating the question makes you arrive at the answer, which is the famous rubber duck debugging technique. So those are always really helpful.
Yeah. And more broadly, like, writing is a form of thinking. So once you're to the point you're actually solving problems, like, there are problems you cannot really solve without writing. Just because the amount of information you have to keep in your head is just too big. And the way we think is too fuzzy. Like, by writing it down, you force yourself to sort of, like, define your terms and where are the terms and, like, what are the abstractions. And so, like, writing is thinking, is a sort of a more robust form of thinking in many cases once you're actually to the point of solving problems.
And coding is thinking too. I think a lot of people only think of code as, like, the final output, like the end product. But code isn't only an end product, it's also a thinking medium. And so in addition to writing things down in English or articulating things verbally in English, in order to make progress on a problem, I will often put my thoughts into code. Not necessarily with the expectation that code I'm writing will ever get committed, but just as a thinking medium.
Yeah, and yeah, just because, yeah, the way, like, it can be easy to not to believe you know what you're thinking about when, in fact, like, the way we think is very not concrete. And that is a useful property. It means, like, you can be creative and you can sort of see things in different ways. But at some point you have to sort of solidify your thinking and go from that sort of cloud of notions into like specific clear boundaries and abstractions and ideas. And that's where writing is really helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really interesting point. We don't always, it sounds weird to say, but like we don't always actually know what we think, and you have to write down what you think in order to discover what you think, which seems like it couldn't possibly be that way, but it really is. One of the other things that I tell people when people are stuck is just try something. If you don't know of a good way to move forward, then move forward in a bad way. If you don't know something smart to try, try something stupid. Just do anything at all, because like being stuck is the worst possible state of being. And even if you're moving forward in the wrong direction, that's usually less costly than not moving in any direction at all. Because when you get moving again, it like jars something loose and enables you to get back on a productive path.
Yeah, and that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, if we talk about like solving problems and identifying problems, we can revisit that a bit.
Yeah. Let's talk about that.
So I find it useful to think about problem solving as there's sort of this Euclidean space of problems, and you can imagine there's like a value function. And so like.
Wait. I don't know these terms. Euclidean space. What does that mean?
So like you imagine like there's there's like a plane, right? You're looking out over a landscape, and like every location, like every longitude and latitude is a problem you could solve. Like, and so related problems are close to each other and unrelated problems are far away from each other. And then the height of the landscape is how valuable solving that problem would be. There's mountains that are like super valuable problems. And then there's little tiny hills that are sort of little tiny problems that aren't that valuable. And so when you're trying to identify problems, you're sort of trying to find like the highest mountain. And then you can think similarly of like this landscape of solutions once you've chosen a problem. And so like related solutions are close to each other and distant solutions are far away. And again, you're like the height of the landscape is the cost to implement the solution. And so now you're looking for valleys. Like you're trying to find the lowest point where the cost is lowest, like the lowest valley. And it's very easy to get stuck in this sort of local minima, like this, like you're in this valley and you're sort of standing there and you say, well, if I walk in that direction, I'm walking uphill. So it's going to cost more to implement. If I walk in that direction, it's going to cost more. So obviously I found the least costly solution, but actually you're just looking at one small area of the solution space. And like, if you were to go further out, you would actually find some much deeper valleys, some much less costly solutions that you could implement much more quickly. And so it's useful to consider a bunch of different solutions to any given problem, just so you can make sure you're searching the solution space pretty well. And I like, it's useful to throw in some silly or seemingly stupid or like just ridiculous solutions in there just to expand the space that you're searching. I think like I do this in everyday life and occasionally in this, my wife gets a little annoyed when like I'm making ridiculous suggestions, and I think it's just a habit that comes over from work. But the like, if you don't just look at the obvious solutions, if you say, okay, how about if we just like if we had a human being do this, or interaction design idea of like, what if it worked by magic? You can come up with sort of fundamentally better solutions. One of my favorite examples is from Havoc Pennington talking about the dangerous UI team, I'm talking about how in the Red Hat Linux distribution, like they like setting up networking was very complicated. And so like they hired some UI designers to build a GUI to configure networking. And the problem with hiring UI designers is that their job is to hire, is to design a UI. Whereas for networking, really what you want is no UI. You want to just plug your computer into the network and have it work. You want to turn the Wi-Fi on and have it work, which is how like modern Linux and Windows and Mac typically work. You don't have to tell it, oh, I have Wi-Fi. It knows that 99% of computers have Wi-Fi and it's pre-configured to just do the right thing. And so starting with some like, can we make it work by magic, just completely transparently, or just a bunch of different approaches will help you search a solution space better and come up with better solutions.
Yeah, I like that. I do that myself. I come up with ideas, possible approaches to a challenge where I don't worry about the constraints of reality at all. I'll list all the ridiculous, absurd things that might come to mind. I might even intentionally try to come up with the most ridiculous things possible. And I'll also, thinking more in a realistic way sometimes, I will say, what if I didn't have any of the constraints that I had? What would be the ideal way for this feature to work? And then I'll start with the ideal way and then bring in the constraints of reality and work backward with from that, rather than saying, here are my constraints, what can I do inside of those? Okay, now how close is that to the ideal way?
Yeah, exactly. And so this is like, once it's complicated enough, like the ideal way to do this is in writing. But also if you are, once you're working at the level of sort of these sort of complex problems, like you're never really coming up with a solution just independently. Really, you're sort of going back and forth between looking at the solution and looking at the problem definition, because the problem definition usually has those constraints in it. And so what you're doing here is like you're saying, I'm going to sort of relax the definition of the problem. I'm going to search some of the problem space because I might be able to find a sort of maybe slightly less valuable problem, but a much, much, much cheaper solution. So like the cost of implementation is sort of the opportunity cost of working on the wrong problem plus the implementation cost of the solution. And so really you sort of end up searching through both and you go back and forth between here's a new solution. Maybe that helps me redefine the problem a little in a better way. And so you end up going back and forth.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned the idea of a problem definition, which I think is really important because it implies that there is a problem definition. And at the risk of repeating myself, a lot of times programmers, including myself in the past, will sit down and start working on something without really knowing what they're trying to accomplish. And so writing down that definition of the problem or goal you're trying to achieve or something like that is hugely helpful because, again, you're not going to accomplish very much if you don't know what you're trying to accomplish. There was another chapter in your book, Itamar, which I thought was hugely important, so I definitely want to make sure we mention this one, which is implement the riskiest part first. What do you mean by that one?
So once you have like a, you're not working on, like if you're working on a 2-hour feature, you just implement it, right? It takes 2 hours, you do it, you're done. But quite often you'll have like a slightly larger project, like it'll take a couple days or 3 days. So example, I got told at one of my jobs that we needed to run some data through this data processing pipeline and generate a report from it. There was a deadline. It's fairly close, and it was new data that hadn't gone through the pipeline before. And this is sort of R&D, so like it was never clear. It wasn't clear yet that you could just put any data through and it would work. And the pipeline could take a few days to run. And so there's, once you have different tasks you can work on, there's a question of what order do you work on them? If you do things in the wrong order, you can find your, like if you do there's always going to be one, typically there'll be one part that's riskier. So you don't understand how it works, or it's more likely to fail, or it's much, it might take much longer, or you have less information. And if you do that part last, you might find yourself just realizing that it's going to take two or three times as much as time as you expected. And since you did it last, like, you don't have any buffers, like, you can't, there's no extra time for you to sort of save yourself or try a different approach. And so if you pick that, like, if you sort of start out by saying, okay, which is the part that's most likely for things to blow up, and do that first, then if things do blow up, you have time to readjust. So in the story I was telling, like, running new data through a pipeline that would take multiple days was far riskier than writing or generating a report. Like, generating a report's pretty easy. So I first ran some small sets of data through the pipeline, found there were some bugs, and so I was able to fix them quickly, then started the data running through the pipeline. And then once that had kicked off, I could in parallel work on the report. But if I'd started on the report first, I would have had less time for the sort of scarier parts.
Yeah. Yeah. This whole thing is a great point. And this is another one of the things I mentioned to you pre-show that is something I've thought a lot about myself. I've always phrased this as do the most mysterious work first, which is basically phrasing the same thing a different way. And this is why it's a great idea to deploy to production on day one of a project rather than waiting until the day before the deadline. If you have a huge marketing push at your company on June 15th, you probably don't want to start trying to deploy to AWS on June 14th, because that is a recipe for stress and makes the chance of failure much higher. And so it's a great idea to do that work much earlier. A little quick story to share. This ties in a couple of things we've talked about so far. I got hired to work at this agency in 2015. When I started, they put me on this particular project. Most of their developers were more toward the junior end of the spectrum, and their project managers weren't very experienced with software. And so the project that I joined had been in the works for about 6 months, and they had no production environment yet. And in fact, they had nothing working to show the client yet. And they had a couple of the mobile developers, like, sleeping in sleeping bags under the desk at the office and stuff like that, working these heroic hours. And yet they didn't actually get something into the hands of the client. And in fact, that project went on for more months, and the whole thing ended up being for naught because they were never able to deliver anything, which kind of, it really drives the point home that, like, working more hours isn't the answer. Doing all this stuff in a more intelligent way is the answer, because if they had done things like do the most risky work first and stuff like that, then they probably wouldn't have had to sleep under the desk, and the project might have actually worked out.
Yeah, and another thing I talk about, sort of the riskiest first part, is sort of, I think about, so once you sort of have the general design figured out, and then when you're designing, like, you're beforehand, you're sort of figuring out the solution, like, when you're figuring out what you're going to be building, the idea is you want, if possible, to design for incremental results. You can't always do this, but if you can deliver value, like, maybe not from day one, but from week one, instead of waiting 6 months to deliver something. Your project is much more likely to succeed, even if nominally this will actually increase how long implementation time will be. Like, it may be that delivering something on week one means that the project will actually take longer, but it's often quite valuable to do that anyway, because by delivering something early, you get faster feedback, your project's less likely to get canceled. And if you run out of time, you run out of budget, if you've done something. And so when it comes not just to there's the implementation side, which is, like, mysterious part, the risky part, you do that first. And there's design side, which is how can you start making something useful as early as possible? even at the cost of slightly longer implementation.
Yeah, I think that's really smart. Paul Graham calls that a kernel of utility. And it also kind of relates to the idea of a walking skeleton, which is like a full end-to-end slice of functionality. A walking skeleton is a little bit more on the nuts and bolts side, where you want to deploy to production and have, for example, the ability to sign in, and your sign-in feature has full test coverage, and you have CI set up and everything. It's a complete slice of everything. That's not necessarily valuable to the user or stakeholder or whatever in itself. So I don't think that's what you're talking about. It seems like what you're talking about is maybe you build your walking skeleton, and then very first thing you do is you build some feature, identify some area where you can carve off a small chunk, which has value of itself. It isn't just a building block for something bigger, but it's valuable on your own. So you can get that into people's hands so they can start using it and start giving feedback. Is that kind of what you mean?
Yeah, and that's one approach. So like, I'm working on a memory profiler for Python, and like, I have these ideas for what a user experience for profiling would look like. But I haven't implemented that. I've just made it. I released something that just barely worked, but was still much better than the alternatives, and then improved the UI. And I added like a feature for like when you run the memory and it crashes, now it reports information sort of, but people would be able to, even though it is not my final vision, like people can start getting value of it now. And so that's sort of a iterative development approach, but in other circumstances, there are other ways you can provide incremental value. So for example, examples like the book is like you get a bug report. And so you figure out that it'll take you a week to implement. Like, you're going to fix this because it's a critical bug, but it's going to take you a week to implement and it's still impacting users. So you might, if it's in a critical enough bug, you might actually decide to spend some time, like spend a day implementing a workaround, like a tool that will help them fix it. And just so that like, you're not leaving them hanging for a week, like you're saying, yes, this is a workaround, and yes, it's going to take me a bit more work because I'm both building a workaround and a bug fix. But this means that I'm helping the customer like from like within a day. And then I can, once they have the workaround, I can go and actually spend the time to fix the bug. And so that's you can provide incremental results by implementing like distinct solutions, or even just like, in some sense, when someone files a bug report, like just being sympathetic is, you could even consider that to be a solution of sorts, because like you're acknowledging that like this is a problem and that this shouldn't have happened and that you're sorry. And so even if it's not a solution for like the specific bug, it's a solution for the sort of more important problem that you have an unhappy customer.
Yeah, that's a great point. Because that will allow you to be much more productive overall if you recognize that there are some things that don't even require you to do actual coding work. There's a story that I heard. There was a hotel or apartment building or whatever. The elevators were kind of slow. People would wait for the elevators. They got bored waiting for the elevators and they complained about it. And the apartment building solution was they installed mirrors in the elevator waiting area, and the complaints stopped because people were no longer bored. They could look at themselves in the mirror while they were waiting for the elevators. So they didn't really solve the root problem. They didn't make the elevators faster, but they solved the problem in a different way, in kind of a superficial way, but the superficial way still genuinely solved the problem. They no longer got any complaints. And I've found that like sometimes just going to users and letting them air their grievances is enough of a, like, letting them feel heard is enough for a lot of things. And maybe they'll say they have problems with these 10 things, and you sympathetically listen and you say, oh yeah, I can understand how that would be frustrating. But then out of those 10 things, you only actually fix one of them, like the worst one out of the 10. they still might be satisfied with that exchange because they at least got to feel heard.
Yeah, and so and that goes back to the there are multiple solutions to any problem. The good rule of thumb is from Charles Weinberg is you should always consider minimum of three solutions. Because if you have two, like you end up in this sort of dichotomy, you have to do this or do that, do this, do that, and you sort of, it doesn't help you sort of think creatively. Once you have three, you're sort of, if there's three, there's got to be four or five or six.
Yeah, that seems like a good idea. Okay, the last thing I want to ask you about before we come to a close is getting better at searching the web. I have a lot of thoughts and opinions about this. What do you have to say about getting better at searching the web?
Yeah, and so this is something where I'm still sort of trying to articulate the skills involved. But I've noticed that, like, I can extract like really useful information from searching the web in ways that sometimes I've seen other people fail to do so. And so I've tried to talk about, like, trying to articulate some of what I'm doing. And so if you're a programmer, like, I remember the days before the web, it was no fun. These days you can, like, you have this vast amount of information available to you and search engines that will search it for you. And so quite often you can just, you know, type your problem in and you'll get an answer, but quite often you won't. The fact you didn't get an answer doesn't mean the answer isn't there somewhere. It might mean you've, like, the search engines to begin with don't search everything. So I have verified, for example, that they're like, I maintain this logging library. It's not that popular, so it doesn't get indexed particularly well. Like, if you want to use my logging library with a specific Python library and you search for it on Google, you'll not find an answer, even though the answer is in the issue tracker. And so one thing you need to do in searching is not just to assume that Google knows everything, but to go and search the documentation, search the issue tracker, maybe search Stack Overflow, because different like local search will have different access to different information than Google. And then, so part of it is where you're searching. And the other part is you might be using the wrong phrase. And this is especially a problem when you're in this problem domain where you don't know the terminology, you don't know what questions to ask. And so often what you need to do is not search in order to find the answer. You need to search in order to find better terminology or find the way people think of the problem. And then you can find a answer, like some article somewhere or some Stack Overflow answer that doesn't actually answer your question, but they're using a different, they're using a term of art that you haven't heard before, or they're using a phrasing you haven't heard before, and then you can go back and search for that. And so part of the search process isn't just looking for answers. Part of it is building up terminology that you can use to try different ways of searching. And then there's a bunch of stuff you can do to sort of expand your scope of your search or shrink it as you get too much or too little answers.
Yeah, man, there are some really good things in there. One thing that you touched on that I've thought about before is, like, when you're searching, think of how other people would have searched for a similar thing, would have searched for the same thing before you. Because if you search for the same thing, but you're using different terminology, you might not land on it. Like, usually there's, for example, one Stack Overflow question where all of the conversation about that particular thing is concentrated. And that's like the gold mine that you need to find. And if you don't phrase your search in such a way that matches what everybody else has searched for in the past, then it makes it less likely that you'll find that gold mine of information that you need. Another thing is, like, just to get really tactical, like, well, let me even back up. Before you search for something, it's really important to pick the right thing to search for. You might get an error message with a big long stack trace. And there's a skill, a really important and valuable skill, in looking at an error in a stack trace and identifying the essence of that error, which might sound obvious, but I've watched people fail at this over and over. So to me, it usually appears at the very beginning or the very end. And then it's important to find the part of that error that is the essence of the error and copy and paste only the right part. Because if you copy and paste too much, then you're going to get the essence of the error, but also stuff that's unique to your situation, which will turn up nothing. Like if you copy and paste your own path to the file where you got the error, you're not going to find anything. But if you copy and paste too little, then your search is going to be way too broad, and then you're going to find a whole bunch of irrelevant stuff. So there's a little bit of an art to figuring out how much of that is relevant and how much of that should go into your search.
Yeah, and another, like, yeah, there's also things like you'll sometimes find the answer for project A in the issue tracker for project B, because project B had to find a workaround for the same issue and they documented it. So sort of knowing that, like, there's actually like a whole bunch of different places like you need to look, and not just the, like, and this works better with popular projects where lots of people are doing workarounds.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's easy to fool yourself into thinking that the error is about something it's not about. Like you get an error, you think it's a Rails error, but really it's a Git error or a Linux error. And so if you get a preconception in your mind of what the error is about, then you might bark up the wrong tree. So it's important to kind of be neutral in the beginning and not form an opinion on what the error is about. Just go searching and then kind of let the things you find inform what it really is, and then you can use those clues to go and chase it deeper.
Yeah, and then sort of another category of problem is assuming that you can find all the information you need on the web, and there is knowledge that you will only find in books, for example, like sort of conceptual knowledge. Like technically you could reassemble it from like 100 different articles, but like if you want to really understand like how relational databases work, you want to get a book.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a really good point. And in fact, I'm learning this more and more as I get older. The entire content of the internet and every book that has ever been written only represents a small fraction of all the useful, important knowledge in the world. And so another way of saying that is most of the important things you can know aren't found in any book or written online anywhere, at least not in one place. Like you can read a lot of books and read a lot of things online and maybe synthesize a lot of important things from that, but a lot of things just aren't written down anywhere at all, which is completely at odds with what I used to think. I used to think all the knowledge in the world was contained in books and online, but really it's not. And I don't know what the proportion is. I don't know if most of the important knowledge is not in any book or online. That's actually probably not true now that I think about it, but there's a lot of stuff that just isn't anywhere.
Yeah, definitely there's a lot of technology knowledge that is sort of oral tradition or like alluded to, or there's a book like from 20 years ago which covers a quarter of it, but it's obsolete because it's from 20 years ago. So like, yeah, you just have to know the right people or sort of like piece it together from different places because it's and occasionally like it's like one of my favorite programming books is the Linux Programming Interface, which is like this giant brick of a book, and it's a huge amount of really useful information if you do systems programming in Linux. And there's a lot of that knowledge is sort of really spread out across people's, like some of it's written down in like Linux kernel documentation, some of it's in man pages, some of it's in like PDFs that be like, you know, that people wrote like papers. And so like lacking this book, they're like all this, like, it'd be really hard to get all this knowledge in one place. And there are topics where, like, no one's written a book, design patterns for logging. There's a bunch of really useful knowledge about how to do logging right. And it's sort of often just siloed by sort of software engineering discipline, like things
yeah.
like.
Yeah, because in order for things to make their way into a book or a blog post or whatever, one of these really smart, knowledgeable people who knows all this stuff has to take time away from something else to put that time into writing a book or writing a blog post or whatever. And not all those people are in the business of doing that stuff.
Yeah. So like embedded programmers all know about circular buffers for logging. And my impression is that lots like programmers in other domains haven't necessarily encountered that idea, which can be very useful in some cases. And I suspect there's other, like there's these ideas that like in one specific discipline or like programming language, everyone knows, and then elsewhere, like just no one's encountered just because it hasn't percolated enough.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Like I did PHP programming for 7 years without ever learning about the idea of a map function, which now to me seems so fundamental. Okay. So that's getting better at searching the web. This seems like a pretty good place to leave it. We covered on a lot of, I think, really good topics, and hopefully this has been educational for the listener. Itamar, where can people go to find you and your work online?
So I write about productivity and negotiation and sort of more non-technological skills for programmers at codewithoutrules.com. And if you're interested in this book I wrote about productivity, it's codewithoutrules.com/secret-skills, I believe. It's linked on the site too. I know that most of the people here are listening are Rails programmers, but if you also write Python, I write about Python stuff at pythonspeed.com.
All right, I'll link all that stuff up in the show notes. Itamar, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.